Now, I mentioned earlier in the service how unusually, perhaps, taking the same passage both morning and evening, albeit taking different sections of it. Of the three prophecies or burdens that you might say that are detailed in this chapter 21 of Isaiah, each refer to three different places and three different stages of fulfillment. The last section, verses 13 to 17, the burden upon Arabia, being the one which, in fact, would be fulfilled first. The other two prophecies, verses 1 to 10 and verses 11 and 12, these both are events which came to pass over 150 years after the days of Isaiah. But of the burden of Arabia, we read at verse 16 that it would come to pass within a year. However, to avoid confusion, rather than deal with the one that would happen earliest first and then get everything out of sync, to avoid confusion, we'll deal with the three prophecies in the order in which they appear. We'll deal with the first one this morning, and Lord willing, we'll deal with the other two this evening. So, first of all, then, verses 1 to 10, the burden of the desert of the sea. Now, though not immediately apparent, the first prophecy is a judgment upon the city of Babylon, whose rise to power was still at this time very much in the future, and whose overthrow, prophesied here, was even further distant. A previous burden upon Babylon had already been prophesied. If you were to turn back to chapter 13, you would see there the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amos, did see, and so on throughout that chapter. But here is another, the burden of the desert of the sea. And that appears initially to be a contradiction in terms. You know, how can you have a desert and a sea at the same time? But in fact, it's a reference to the plain in which the city of Babylon was built. In ancient times, the Euphrates River simply spread over this whole flat plain area, like one gigantic marsh, a vast sea, one might say. But an ancient Babylonian king dug, or arranged to be dug, a single deep channel, dammed up all the other little tributaries and streams and rivers which spread out from the Euphrates, and caused it to run deep and strong in this one single channel that he had created. And this then in turn both acted as a defense for one side of the city. The river ran along one side, so he was defended on that side, and it simultaneously turned the former sea, the widespread marsh, into a desert, because it drained off all that land and focused it all in the single channel. So we have the desert of the sea in that sense. And one reason how the Medes finally captured Babylon was that they broke the dams and the dikes holding in the Euphrates. And so they flooded the plain again. And that caused the main channel to dry up, because it wasn't getting fed by all these tributaries and marshes and so on. So the main sort of channel dried up. They were able to cross it dry shod and get into the city that way, and so take it and capture the city. The desert became a sea again. This is Babylon. That's what it's a prophecy about. And this prophecy, so far ahead of its time, was needful for the Israelites. Remember that none of it came to pass until 150 years after the days of Isaiah. Now, that would mean that if Isaiah had been prophesying something that was going to happen like this year, then he would have been doing it in like 1867 or thereabouts. So it's that far away, that distant in terms of fulfillment. But it's so far ahead of his time, it's still needful, because it was important for God's people to understand the ultimate destiny of Babylon and have it repeated to them. Because although Babylon was to become a vicious enemy and a great oppressor of Israel, she originally posed as a friend. And if you turn to chapter 39 in Isaiah, you'll see there how after King Hezekiah got sick, that representatives came from the king of Babylon to ask after his welfare and to see if he was okay. He showed them all his treasure house, and he showed them all his city and all his defences and everything. And at that time, remember, Babylon was just a very minor little kingdom. It was no threat to anybody. And this was just almost, you might say, whether a scouting trip or just building up diplomatic relations. But Isaiah, at the end of that chapter, he warns Hezekiah and says, you've shown him everything. Now, the time will come when everything that you've shown these people will be carted off into Babylon in captivity. It would be far in the future, but it would happen. And so Babylon posed initially as a friend, but it would in due course become a vicious enemy. And obviously parallels with the world and all its bedazzling powers and so on should be coming into our minds at this point. The world poses as a friend. Particularly to the Christian, it can sort of dazzle you into thinking, yeah, the world wants your friendship. Yeah, the world wants to respect you. It wants you to respect them, of course. So if you become as much like the world as you can, then they will be your friend. And they will approve of you. And you won't be like these nasty, bigoted, fundamentalist kind of Christians. You'll be a friend to the world. It'll be a friend to you. But really, all it wants is power over you. All that Babylon wants at the end of the day is to control Israel and the rest of its empire. It poses as a friend, but it becomes a vicious persecutor. And we see, even in our own land, the extent to which Christians are persecuted and marginalized and attacked or ridiculed and so on, as we see in every sphere of life. And of course, the persecution is far more overt in other countries. But the message was that the Lord's people should be neither taken in by Babylon's friendship nor afraid of her enmity, because her ultimate destruction had been decreed and now, in this chapter, foretold. The overthrow of Babylon came to pass in the days of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. If you look at Daniel chapter 5, then you see there the night in which Babylon fell. And what were they doing, of course? They were feasting and eating and drinking and having a party right up to the last minute. So that describes the occasion on which Babylon fell, far in the future from Isaiah's day. But we see the parallels with the power of the world in Babylon. It poses as a friend. It becomes an enemy. But God has the measure of it from the very beginning. You shouldn't be either taken in by its friendship nor fearful of it as an enemy, because its destruction, its final destruction of the world and everything in it. Peter has foretold us this, and the other apostles and so on, how this world is going to come to an end. The Lord has it all under his control. The overthrow of Babylon did come to pass, and now to us it's like ancient history, but to the people then it's far, far distant in the future. And we read it's as a whirlwind. As a whirlwind in the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert, from a terrible land. Whirlwind in the desert, like a sandstorm, you might say. So would the Medes and the Elamites that were described in verse 2. You know, go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media, all the sighing thereof have I made to cease. They would come blazing through the land from their own deserts and their scorched rock mountains in what is now northern Iran. That is where they originally came from. Their own was a terrible and inhospitable land, which was fierce to strangers and bred tough soldiers. The vision is fearful. It's dreadful even for an Israelite prophet to behold. It talks about the treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously. This would Babylon, because it would be Babylon because how it dealt with others, and this too would be her own downfall. Some translators have it, the treacherous dealer has found one who deals treacherously, and the spoiler one who spoils. Now again, this is what happens in the world. The kind of standards that it seeks to bring into its operation, as it seeks to leave behind the Christian values of which our own society, for example, was built, it begins to implode. And the kind of tactics that are used initially against the old establishment or Christian ways of doing things, of picking them apart and so on, that then gets done to them in turn by others. Because when you've taken away all the restraints and all the values and all the God-based laws, what have you got left but effectively, you know, political cannibalism? That's what we've got just now. And that's what was happening in these ancient days. One empire rises up, another empire comes and gobbles it up. You deal treacherously with one set of people, somebody else deals treacherously with you. Isaiah 33, of course, spells this out. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. Now, ordinary history, secular history, tells us that two turncoat officers of the king of Babylon defected to the Median army and led them up the various streets and avenues straight to the place where Belshazzar, the king of Babylon at the time, was slain. And the city was spoiled and plundered, even as Babylon had done to others. The sign which is made to cease, verse 2 there, is the sign of her captives, her slaves, her oppressed. Psalm 12 at verse 5 says, for the oppression of the poor, for the sign of the needy, now will I arise, saith the Lord. I will set him in safety from him that puffeth at him. Babylon was great, but nothing, not even brutality and oppression, lasts forever. Eventually, you upset or you oppress so many people that others rise up against you. Nothing lasts forever. No political power, no empire, no force, however great, lasts forever. And you can think of any of the great empires of the past. You can think of any of the great political powers. You can even see, you know, again, in our own country, it goes cyclically. There are times when you think one party, oh, they're in an absolutely unassailable position, and then a few years later, they're down to nothing, and somebody else is up. And then other people take over again. You know, just look at the political revolution, don't mean in the terms of violent revolution, but revolutions in the sense of turning of the wheel. If you compare 20 years ago, 1997, the Labour landslide, and then later on, you've got the Labour coming down with one seat in Scotland, same as the Tories, same as the Lib Dems. You have SNP coming up, and then the SNP beginning to lose seats again as the others come back again. So nothing lasts. Whatever the different political powers, whatever the forces of the powers, at the moment, America's the only world superpower really, but Russia's coming back up again, China's another one. You know, nothing is lasting. No empire, no strength, no power is going to last permanently. Even brutality and oppression like that of Babylon and that of the Medes and the Persians and so on, it passes away. The Roman Empire lasted for hundreds of years. It passed away. The British Empire, it passed away. Nothing is going to last forever, however strong they may seem for a time. Only God is eternal. And this is one of the reasons why this is being prophesied in advance to the Israelites, to let them see this little distant kingdom that is soon going to send messengers to your king. They're going to rise up and become a great empire. They're going to oppress you. They're going to grind you down. They're going to burn your city to the ground. They're going to destroy Jerusalem. They're going to be the first people ever to seriously capture it and destroy it. And they will completely take you into captivity and destroy you. But they won't last forever. They too will be destroyed and you'll be brought back again. Now, this, people would say, yeah, but you know, Isaiah can't possibly have prophesied this in advance. Skeptics will say, you know, it must be written after the event. References in verse 2, as you see there, to Media and Elam, the Medes and the Elamites. We tend to think of them in later on in Bible history as the Medes and the Persians. But in fact, we have here proof of the authenticity, the genuineness of this prophecy as being from Isaiah in his time. Not some later forgery, subsequently dubbed into the Old Testament, as some liberal scholars would have us believe. There are those who consider the detailed accuracy of Isaiah's prophecies to be just too much to swallow. It couldn't possibly be genuinely from Isaiah in his day. He couldn't possibly have all these details, which we later learn actually happened. And just pretending, somebody else could have done it, just pretending to be from the pen of Isaiah. Must have been written after the event, just pretending it was Isaiah. But if that were the case, the writer would think, like us, in terms of Medes and Persians. He wouldn't talk about Elamites in that sense. But in Isaiah's day, the term Persians, a term which means horsemen, it's a sort of name applied to a nation focused on cavalry, was unknown. These ancient peoples were referred to as Elamites until after the time of the exile to Babylon. And if you check, you'll notice that the only biblical references to Medes and Persians are in the exile prophets. In Daniel and Ezekiel and Esther, for example, those whose position in history is after the exile, after the fall, after they've been taken into Babylon and the Persians have taken over them. So they're the only ones that know about Persians. Isaiah doesn't know about Persians. He only knows about Elamites. Just to give you a wee example. Now, a couple of years ago, some of you may have heard me use this example before, in which case I apologise, having a conversation with a Christian lady at the dinner table about somebody who'd been a missionary in Rhodesia. And two young Christian people at the table, who are perfectly intelligent, nothing wrong with their knowledge, looked at this wide-eyed and said, "Where's Rhodesia?" Now, for those of a certain generation, myself or older or whatever, you'll think, "Oh, imagine not knowing what Rhodesia was." They didn't know, because it was like 35, 36 years since that country's name had been changed to Zimbabwe. They didn't know where Rhodesia was. Now, people of my parents' generation would probably think mentally of it in terms of southern Rhodesia rather than Rhodesia itself, because it's a different name for the same piece of land, a different name from like the 1890s to the 1960s. People of my own generation think in terms of Rhodesia, maybe then Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, and also conscious of, yes, when it becomes Zimbabwe, well, we know what Rhodesia is. They didn't know, because their generation didn't even think in those terms, because the name had changed. Likewise, if somebody were in the 1960s talking about Sri Lanka, and you would think, well, why are they? What's that country they're talking about? Because in the 1960s, it hadn't changed to Sri Lanka, it was Ceylon. Everybody talked about Ceylon. That's where it was, like where the tea comes from, and so on. So all of these things, they changed their names and their designations. And the fact that Isaiah doesn't know about Persians indicates that he is talking in his own genuine period of history. The understanding, the terminology hasn't changed yet. He still thinks in terms of Elamites and also Media and so on. This is indicative of the genuineness of this prophecy in its day. And we think, okay, well, fine, you've established that, but what does it have to do with us? Look again at where the prophet is kind of thinking himself now, verses 3 to 5, into the position of the king of Babylon. On the night when Babylon falls, pangs have taken hold of me. My loins are filled with pain. Pangs as of the woman at travail. I was bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. My heart panted. Fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. Now, this is literally fulfilled in what happens to Belshazzar on the night when Babylon falls. Daniel chapter 5, verse 6. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. And again in verse 4, as we said, no, the night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear. Surely this is true. Well, the king also in the night of the feast, he's having a party. He's bringing out all the gold cups. They're feasting away and drinking their wine in all the cups of the Lord from his temple and all the other gods of their different countries of the empire. Mirth, gaiety, indulgence, intending when the time came to arise then and be ready to war. You know, it says, the night is turned into fear. Prepare the table. Watch in the watchtower. Eat, drink, arise, ye princes, and anoint the shield. In other words, keep having your party, but when the alarm comes, when the time comes, then get up, then anoint the shield, then get ready your armor, and then be ready to meet the foe. It's too late then. By the time the battle comes on you, you can't be preparing for it then. It's too late then to make sure that your shield is all well oiled and that your sword is sharp and so on. But that's what they're doing. Partying right up to the last minutes. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear. Prepare the table. Watch in the watchtower. Eat, drink, arise, ye princes, anoint the shield when the time comes. But for now, let's just carry on with our party. This is the state in which Babylon was found. They were having mirth and gaiety and indulgence and feasting, intending when the time came, oh, then we'll be ready for war. Then we'll get ready. Just like the five foolish virgins. When they say, oh, well, when the bridegroom comes, Then we'll get oil for our lamps then. Then we'll make sure that we're all filled up. Well, that won't be any use to. It'll be too late then. How many of us think like this? Like the king of Babylon here. When we see the signs, when we hear the alarm, then is time enough to stir ourselves to seek the Lord. For now, there's so much today. We've got partying to do. We've got things to enjoy. We've got our life here. We want the world. We want the world and all its enjoyment and all its good things. And it's time enough, you know. If we hear a thunder in the east and we see the sign of the Lord in heaven, we'll quickly time then to go and start reading my Bible. Quickly time then to fall on my knees and pray for the Lord's forgiveness. No, there isn't. By the time you see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, it's too late then. Then time has come to an end. We have to be ready beforehand, just like the Babylonian Shuman, ready beforehand, just like we have to be ready beforehand. Yes, there's a place for a measure of eating and drinking and getting our strength, but we can't expect to live our lives right up to the wire as though this is not going to happen, and then at the last minute say, okay, let's all get ready now. No, get ready now. Be ready now, so that when it comes, it will not take you unawares. We ourselves must be watchful upon the Lord's call. This is what Jesus said in Mark's account of the Gospel, chapter 13. Read from verse 32. But of that day and that hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take ye heed, watch, and pray, for ye know not when the time is. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to every man his work, and commanded the porter to watch. Watch ye therefore, for ye know not when the master of the house cometh, at even, or at midnight, or at the cock crowing, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. Now that's the words of Jesus. What I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. It's not just the king of Babylon who's going to be caught out there when he sees the Elamites and the Medes coming against him. It's not just them who can be foolish and think, time to party, time to eat and drink, plenty of time, plenty of security and safety. It says in Daniel chapter 5, that very night Belshazzar was slain. Jesus says in his parable about the rich fool, you know, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who shall these things be which thou hast laid up for thyself? So we see in verse 7, the watchman is set. You see that the watchman sees a chariot. He saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot of asses and a chariot of camels. And he hearkened diligently with much heed. Now, perhaps more accurately when it says a chariot, the word chariot can also be translated as a column of two, a pair coming towards you, two abreast. The same term can be used either for that, a column of two abreast, or for a chariot, with two attending horsemen. Now, doubtless, the reference to horsemen, remember how we said Persians means horsemen, it could be a reference to those leading, be Cyrus of the Persians when the time came, when that was fulfilled. But another column, two abreast of asses, or mules, as favoured by the Elamites. They were great into their donkeys and mules and so on. So this will be a symbolic viewing by the watchman, seeing the mules or the donkeys, the asses coming. And then camels, those favoured by the Medes. It's these animals are being taken as sort of symbolic of the nations. Just as if you think of, if you ever see a royal coat of arms, you know, you've got a lion on one side and a unicorn on the other. What are these animals symbolic of? The lion is symbolic of England. The unicorn is symbolic of Scotland. If somebody was to say, "Oh well, I saw this vision. There was this bed of earth, and in this bed of earth there was four kinds of plants growing. There was daffodils, and there was shamrocks, and there was thistles, and there was roses." Now, anyone think, "Oh yeah, okay, that's our four emeralds. That's it." Shamrock of Ireland, the daffodils of Wales, the thistle of Scotland, the rose of England. Yeah, that means our four nations. That means something to do with the United Kingdom. Now, somebody from completely elsewhere wouldn't think these plants associate these things, but we would know. We would say, well, these are the particular emblems of our country. So likewise in Isaiah's day, the horsemen, the asses, the camels, these indicate these particular nations, the Medes, the Elamites, and almost certainly the Persian leaders at the front there. So it's a clearer picture of the nationalities that will be involved in the invasion and the overthrow of Babylon. And it could hardly be found. All of this is far in the future. It couldn't be clearer for the people of that day. Now when he says in verse 8, a lion, my Lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower. A lion is renowned, apparently, biologically, with very short eyelids. They have short eyelids that don't, you know, don't come down that far over their eyeballs, apparently. Maybe all cat groups do, I don't know. But because of their short eyelids, they're taken often as a symbol of watchfulness. That's one reason why, you know, you often get statues of lions symbolically guarding temples or important buildings. The lions are facing outward, couching or sitting up, always awake. You don't have statues of lions lying down asleep. You've got them sitting up, alert or watchful, you know, couching, looking out, guarding, as it were, because they are watchful. Short eyelids, a watchful creature. My Lord, a lion, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime and sit in my ward whole nights. And behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Now the couple of horsemen, the chariot of horsemen, again symbolizing the commander-in-chief coming into Babylon itself. Once Babylon is breached, once its walls are breached, it's kind of like breaching the hull of a ship, breaching the Titanic at the front. Nobody's going to be daft enough to say, well, it's okay, it's just a wee hole at the front, the bottom of the ship. You know, we're back, we're fine here back at the stern. Once the hull is breached, the water's going to come pouring in. Once the city wall is breached, the enemy's going to come pouring in. Here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. He answered and said, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Repetition in the Bible, remember, means emphasis. Jeremiah 51 verse 31 says, one post shall run to meet another, one messenger running to meet to catch up with another, to show the king of Babylon that his city is taken at one end. Once in, the defense is effectively over. It could be the charioteer who answers the prophet, but most likely it is the Lord himself saying, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Her useless idolatry is shown for what it is. Now, the knowledge that Babylon is taken as being symbolic of iniquity, of sin, of idolatry in general, we find that, of course, in the New Testament, in Revelation, where you've got a repetition, an echo of this very verse, in chapter 14 at verse 8. There followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations to drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Because the city is punctured at one end, it's no use the king saying, that's okay, I'm here at the other end, I'm far away from where the damage is coming in. No, once they pour in, it's only going to go one way. Now we have to, in terms of spiritual terms, defend ourselves on all sides against the evil one. It's no use saying, well, almost all of my life is given to the Lord, but this wee bit here, this wee bit isn't given to the Lord, this bit I'm keeping for myself. That's where the devil will get in. That is where his hordes will pour in. His spirit will get in. His attacks will be upon you. The soft underbelly where the Lord is not guarding you, where his armor of God is not protecting you, because you have kept that bit from being brought under the sovereignty of God's protection. And that is the danger for every one of us, that we may think that, well, you know, 9/10 of my life is given to the Lord. But this bit, no, I want to keep that bit for myself. You know, this much of the Lord is for the Lord. This much, this, this, and this, I'll do the Lord's way, but this bit's going to be my way. This bit's for me. Now, the devil is not going to attack the strong bit where the Lord is in control. He's going to attack the soft bit, the easy bit, where you are in control. And that's where he will bring in his attacks. That's where your wall will be breached. That is where the enemy will come in like a flood. Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he hath broken unto the ground. Babylon is taken as being the mother of all idolatry. If we think back to Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel, and that's literally what Babel is a reference to. Babylon, it's the ancient name for Babylon. The Tower of Babel, the essence of idolatry is not images and statues of gods and deities. The essence of idolatry is to put man in the place of God. I'll say that again. The essence of idolatry is to put man in the place of God. That was the temptation, remember, in the garden, was it not? Oh, you'll be like gods. You eat of this fruit and you'll know everything God knows. That's the temptation. And when man gives in to that temptation, then sin is in there. And then the destructive process begins. Idolatry. Man seeking to be in the place of God. And all false religion, if you think about it, you think of any kind of religion you can think of other than biblical Christianity, and you will find that it focuses on the place of man. That man has to be able to pay for his own sins and climb his way up to heaven. He's going to be able to do the things, do the good deeds, pay the amounts, and earn his salvation so he can say he's righteous at the end of the day. How it's not fair if God should have this free grace of election. Because what about if we've done our best? What about if I've done this, this, and this? False religion will say, yes, do this, do that, do the next thing, and you will get to God's heavenly paradise. False religion puts man at the center and the control center of his own destiny. True religion puts God at the center of the heart, the soul, the life, the experience, and the universe. True religion has God at the heart. False religion, idolatry, puts man where God should be. And it doesn't matter whether that false religion wears a supposedly Christian face. It doesn't matter whether it wears a pagan face or that of another world religion. The end result is always the same. Put man at the center instead of God. That is the essence of idolatry. All the rest, all the statues and the false gods and all the fastings and pilgrimages and so on are just the inventions of men's evil hearts and empty heads to replace God with something else. Oh, my threshing, verse 10. The corn of my floor, that which I have heard of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, have I declared unto you. Now, in the first instance, Isaiah is saying, look, I'm telling you what the Lord has told me to say. That which the Lord of God of Israel, has given me, I declare to you. Now, Paul makes the same kind of statement. If you think of it, every time we have the Lord's Supper, we take the authority from 1 Corinthians 11. And often, many a minister begins at verse 23. I have received of the Lord that which also I delivered unto you, that the Lord Jesus, the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread, and so on. Paul is stating, I didn't make this up. I received this from the Lord Jesus Christ himself. That's why I'm telling you, Corinthians. That's why I'm telling the other churches. And this is what Isaiah is saying. I have heard of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, and I've declared it to you. Now, when he says, my threshing and the corn of my floor, it sounds as though God has beaten his people with a threshing instrument and beaten them very low. And certainly they are afflicted. They are afflicted by beating thresh with the flailing rod till they lie bruised and crushed upon the floor. So it sounds. And so it may look, particularly when you look at the level of persecution against Christians throughout the world. And it doesn't matter who their enemy is. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, atheistic communism or whether it's Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam or humanism in the West. Whatever it may happen to be, they all have the same enemy. Whatever they're coming from, they all have the same enemy. And that same enemy is Christ and his people. Because the world instinctively recognizes that which is not of the world. So yes, you can say, oh, my threshing and the corn of my floor, as if the Lord's people are getting battered and flailed and thrashed and so on, and they are just lying bruised and broken on the threshing floor. And certainly they are very afflicted. But what is the Lord really saying here? What is the end result when you have threshed the corn? It means that what you have is no longer chaff. It means that what you gather up from the barn of floor is pure corn, the kernel, the best of the wheat, the finest of the wheat. That is what the threshing produces. The chaff is thrown up into the air and blown away. All the excess is torn away, that which endures, the hard, solid kernel, that which is the finest of the wheat, is that which is left. When the Lord has finished his threshing, when he has finished the purifying like silver, what he is really saying is that Israel, the chosen of God, the church of Jesus Christ in every age, are made to become, even if they wouldn't choose that threshing for themselves, are the finest of the wheat. They are God's chosen, the kernels of the threshing floor, as opposed to the chaff of the wind. This is spoken for their comfort. He has declared what he will do. The truth from the Lord's mouth has the prophet uttered, as solemn and certain as the authority of God himself. That which I have heard of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, have I declared unto you. Now, it's not just about an ancient overthrow of an ancient empire far away. What applies to Babylon physically in the distant future in Isaiah's day soon became the distant past, just as it is for us now. The fall of Babylon is ancient history to us in physical terms. But the reality of Babylon in spiritual terms, its downfall is prophesied just as surely as physical Babylon's. We read it there in Revelation. Babylon is fallen, is fallen. It is going to be overthrown. Just now it is still at war with the Lord's people. Just now the war is still going on. But none of us can say we have not had warning. This was the message for Isaiah's day, though it were then so far in the future. This is the message for our times, though the fulfillment may be well nigh upon us. When God speaks, he always speaks the truth. That which I have heard of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, have I declared unto you. He has revealed his very self. And that is what he says. If we go back again to the last book of the Bible, when it prophesies the falling of the true Babylon, the spiritual Babylon, how does that book, the book of Revelation, begin? This is how it starts. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John, who bare record of the word of God and of the testimony of Jesus Christ and of all things that he saw. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. This is not just some dim and distant prophecy of a faraway affliction or a faraway conflict. This is a prophecy for our time of the true Babylon, of how it will be overthrown, and how the Lord is revealing this to us and making it known to us. And yes, we may be threshed in the process. But if he is giving us a threshing, it is because he desires us to be the finest of the wheat at the last. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand.